Social Flight is brought to you by Aspen Avionics, Avidyne, Continental Aerospace Technologies, Lightspeed Aviation, Tempest Aero Group, and Whip Air. And now, here's your host, Jeff Simon.
This episode of Cockpit to Cal is made possible by Avemco Insurance. Mention Social Flight for a 5% insurance discount at avemco.com, subject to terms and conditions. Welcome to Cockpit to Cal, the show that explores general aviation safety topics from the combined perspective of flight instructors, pilots, and mechanics, exploring both pilot and aircraft topics to make aviation safer and more enjoyable. I'm Jeff Simon, pilot, AMP/IA, and president of Social Flight.
I'm Brian Schiff, a 36-year airline captain and been actively flight instructing for 40 years now.
Brian, this is a show that I've been waiting for quite some time. I'm very excited about. We get questions throughout our every one of the Cockpit to Cal shows that we do. People type in questions there. And occasionally, since it's just you and I doing the show, we can kind of look at it a little bit of what's coming in, and it steers our conversation a tiny bit. But in general, we store those and try to just kind of handle them separately. And this is a show that you and I decided we are going to just answer people's questions.
Yeah. And so there are some great ones there, and so many. I mean, some fantastic questions, and I thank everybody for submitting those. I look forward to getting to these. We obviously will only get the tip of the iceberg today.
That's true. So I want everybody out there to know that we had hundreds of questions. And so the reality is, what we're really going to try to do is look at some of them that came in more than once that were more common things that people want to answer, and maybe a few kind of interesting ones that we think will help people out. But it doesn't mean that your question doesn't matter. So keep submitting those. We'll do everything we can. And I think we might end up making this a little bit more of a regular thing that we do. What do you think, Brian?
I think we definitely should. It's the topics are way more broad than what you and I could just think up together. So for sure, we'll be doing more of this.
Okay, so you want to do rock, paper, scissors or something to see who goes first?
No, I always lose that. So if we do that, you could just go first.
So you want me to kick it off?
Yeah, go for it. You can do that.
Okay. All right. First one that came in here was actually a very, very important maintenance question. It was, how did you guys meet? That's a question I got right by someone. So I want to tell this story. Just, you know, I know you're a little, you may not want to tell the story, Brian, but so we're walking down a hall. Actually, I was running.
You're not going to talk about it.
I had a truck shot, I had a Hershey bar in my hand. You were running the other way. You had a jar of peanut butter, I think. And somehow we just realized that that's just the best combination.
Was that what happened at the truck stop? I don't have a lot of memory of our truck stop meeting. So.
All right. I'm gonna cheat a little bit with a couple of these because I got the same kind of question in multiple ways, and it sort of includes a couple topics. And the first one, or I'll do mine and then you can kind of go, but it is the top five must-do maintenance items on an aircraft. What are the top five things that I think are most important for someone to do on their airplane? And that's a great question, right? Because it's the kind of things that as an educated owner, you should always have top of mind, even if your mechanic isn't looking at that. It's what I think should be really important to you, especially since maintenance shouldn't be an annual event. We make it
that way. I'm actually eager to hear the answer to this one.
Right. I mean, as an owner, I want to make sure that myself and that I'm educating other people from a mechanic perspective, not to think of things as save everything up for your mechanic and then just trust them. I think it's something that should happen on a regular basis. And that's why these top five, I think, are really important. So these are not in any particular priority order, but I do want to kind of lay them out there. So the first one is obvious. It's something that really matters for us to do. Oh, there you go. I like that. He's paying attention.
I want to know.
Oil filter and checking and oil analysis. Obviously, this is something that everyone should be doing in terms of at least doing your oil change and checking your filter. But the analysis part of it is a little kind of, some people do it, some people don't. It's really, really important for trends. These two things do very different things. An oil filter is telling you if there's metal being produced that's visible, that's a large enough piece that you can actually see it and detect it in the filter. And the analysis is giving you trend information as to whether you're starting to produce microscopic amounts, parts per million of metal, and if it's going up or it's going down, or it might be related to downtime or something like that. And a little tip I want to put here is anything that you get in there, you should be, if you're not doing it yourself, make sure your mechanic is instructed for it. But every filter that you take out, you cut open and you examine, put it in the Ziploc bag, put the total time on it, put the date on it, and store it somewhere. Maybe a year later you can toss it out, but just keep it, because if things change, you might want to look back again and see, did I miss something? I have a bunch of metal now. Was there really no metal last time? Or if you have some that you have to collect it and send it in for analysis, you still want that filter. So maintain that. All right. So that's one.
That's great.
I don't want to take the whole show of my top five here. Next one, borescope. Now, borescoping. You know, I work really closely with my good friend Mike Bush. He's a huge proponent of borescoping. Every owner should own one. They are not expensive. And what we're learning is that you really should borescope it pretty much at every oil change. If every 50 hours or so you are inspecting that, then you are on top of something when it's repairable. You're going to find, we're usually looking for valve issues or scraping on the side of the cylinder, things like that. But learning to look for things there, and we can talk about that in a separate episode about what to look for. But I think it's really, really important. So borescope, oil filters we talked about. The next thing is going to be mag maintenance. Magnetos are a wear item. We don't usually think of them that way. And they're a little bit of a catch-22 because we have two of them. And so you might be led to believe and want to believe that if you lose a mag, you have another mag. And so it's a system designed for failure. But there's two issues here. One is mags have fragile components inside. They have a lot of nylon and components that are affected by heat and time. And we just know that they're going to fail at some point. And when they fail, that second part, it can be failing in a nasty way. So a mag can fail in a way that it doesn't just stop working. If it did, we'd be like, oh, we just lost a little bit of power and we're now on our good mag. It can fail in a way that advances your timing or changes the timing out of that mag and it's still firing.
Well, and also to help make your point, as you gave me that advice, we had the mags checked. I just got my airplane out of manual. Probably going to say that a lot of times. But when the mags were looked at, they were both trashed. They said the blah, 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 but these are both all chewed up and trashed and it needs to be rebuilt. But that was both mags. Both of them were equally chewed up.
Yeah, it's, you know, they're aware of them. It's really important to stay on top of it. It's one of the things you don't want to run to failure. And Brian, I want to add something else to this, because one of the reasons that engines fail after a mag fails is because pilots seem uncomfortable playing with the mags in flight. And I use the term playing, you know, jokingly, but the reality is, what are your thoughts on this as a pilot? Because as a mechanic, I sort of don't get it. Why are pilots so uncomfortable using the mag switch in flight?
Well, I think it's fear of the unknown. What a pilot uses that for is to secure the engine. And that's not what we want to do in flight. So when we're doing testing and checking, you know, it's really fear of the unknown. What's going to happen when I turn that off? And I think that's why most pilots are afraid of it. I don't have a problem going to one mag and then back to both and the other mag back to both. If we have a problem, you know, I kind of do it quickly. But it's very important to me that I'm very deliberate. I don't want to go to off. I don't want to, you know, even if I did. Yeah. It's going to come back in all likelihood, but that's not what I want to do. So I'm very deliberate about when and if I do it in flight.
That's a very good point. You do want to be careful. You know, your goal isn't to shut it off. If you do shut it off, you know, the worst that can happen, you're going to get a backfire of some kind, which could damage your muffler system or something like that if it were extreme. But I would like that to be part of people's emergency list, that when the engine's running rough, I want them comfortable checking left mag, right mag. It seems like if you're not comfortable doing that, how do you know that the other mag isn't damaging your engine?
Right. I think it's important because you might go, if you have a rough engine and you go to one mag, it might solve your problem. Right.
Yeah, exactly. All of a sudden, yeah, the engine's running fine. As far as you can tell, you don't know that it's a little reduced power perhaps, but yeah.
Right.
So that's my other one, mags. So now we've got three out of the five there. Next one on the list is for Lycoming. Now, when we talk about borescope inspections, both Lycoming and Continental engines can burn valves, but Continental engines is much more susceptible to it. And the reason is because Lycoming valves are sodium filled. They use the stem of the valve to dissipate heat. And so they tend, you know, on Continentals, you're dissipating all that heat through the face of the valve where it hits the seat. Every time it hits the seat, metal to metal contact, and the heat gets to transfer. So it's really important to have a good seal there, and have that heat transfer take place. And if it isn't happening, you worry about the valve burning. You want to catch it early so you can repair it without pulling the cylinder. On Lycomings, as we mentioned, because that heat transfer is happening in the guide, because that heat's transferred down the stem of the valve and then out to the guide, that has its own problems because it tends to start, coking up any oil that's in there. You tend to get contaminants and carbon and things like that in that stem, which means the valve will stick.
What's the advice for the valve? What are you saying to do to the valve?
So there's a service bolt in 388C that is a valve wobble check. There's a tool you can buy, and it's not hard to do, and you can just wobble it and make sure that it's that is clear and easy to, you know, that it meets the specs and you know it's not sticking. But you know, I'll tell you, I've talked to more than one mechanic that has actually said, hey, every whatever 400 hours on a Lycoming engine, I ream the valves. So what the service bulletin says is, when you have this at a certain interval, check the valve. You basically put a gauge on it and you literally wobble it to see if there's enough room. And if it fails, then they say, here's how you ream the guide, which it basically means you have a special tool. You push the valve into the cylinder. You still do this without removing a cylinder. You clean it out basically, and then you're done, because the tool is the exact diameter you want when you're done. And so some mechanics have just said it takes less time or the same amount of time for me to do the corrective action than it
wobble
does to do
and ream if necessary.
Wobble and ream if necessary.
Got it. Okay, yep. Cool.
And then there's my last item on the list. And this one might be a surprise one. Batteries. Talk about neglected items. Batteries seem to get neglected all the time. People go, they let them age until they fail. Which if you're an IFR pilot, seems like a foolish thing to do. They leave a master on and the battery is dead, and then they just charge it and think they're fine. It can permanently damage an engine, a battery, if it's left to a certain degree. So capacity checking, your mechanic should have a tool that can check the capacity of your battery, or you should take it to someone who can. And you should know, you should maintain your battery, because you can really rely on it, unless you're flying an aircraft that doesn't have an electrical system, or you are just really want to tell yourself that all you care about is VFR happy days. I think that's really, really important. So that's my list.
I keep a trickle charger on them, on my battery, you know, like a maintaining. You know, so if I go a long period of time, it's not going to sit there and drain or whatever, but it's kept up. And then the second thing I do is I will replace it, you know, after a couple of years max. I'm like, it's cheap insurance to me. Just get a new one. I mean, I see it as a disposable thing. It's not a lot of money. And to me, it's the value of not having it go bad during flight is worth just having a new one and reliability factor.
And you could argue with what you're saying that the cost of having someone do a capacity check weighs against the cost of just getting a new battery. Batteries are, depending on your battery, can be very expensive, but it's a good point. I would just encourage people, if you fly, it matters no matter what. Yeah. And yet, if you're flying in weather, if you're flying IFR, if you're flying long distances where you could be stranded somewhere.
Yeah.
Don't.
Yeah, it's good advice. Really. And I've had all five of those we just did on my annual. So I'm proud. Of course, I had your advice as well. So glad that I did these things. The borescope.
Go ahead. Yeah.
Well, can you see a trend in borescope? Like if you keep the photos from the borescope, trends will be indicative of a problem?
Yes, yes. And the cool part, this is why I get excited about borescopes. The cool part about it is it's one of those things that if you catch something early, it can be a, you know, $200-$300 fix instead of like a $3,000-$4,000 fix. And the only difference is you looked. That's it.
Yeah, I'm going to get myself a borescope. I know that I do it during every annual, but if I do it every oil change now and just I pay for the savvy services, so if I just send them my borescopes every oil change, they'll look at it and keep an eye on that and let me know what they see. I don't want to be the expert looking at it, but I'm happy to, you know, go get the pictures.
Got it. All right, Brian, your turn. Your turn. I tucked up enough oxygen here. Go.
I had a question. So one was, and these were a while ago, I kind of went through these and we're going to have to do this again for sure. But what were the results of the engine idle or engine stopped for glide ratio? I had mentioned that on one of our previous episodes. So someone asked what the results were when Dan and I went up and tested. We actually learned some very eye-opening things. So the question is, how will your airplane glide better if you are idling? You know, you have an engine idling is producing a little bit of thrust. So it's not just all drag of windmilling the propeller. Then you have a windmilling propeller where that's the work of turning that propeller causes a lot of drag. Or you have a stopped propeller where your engine's actually shut down and the propeller stops. The least amount of drag is obviously with that propeller stopped. But to keep the end result kind of short story, when we simulate an engine failure with an engine at idle, I think we're doing a pretty good job of simulating this is about what it's going to be like with the propeller stopped. Maybe it's going to be a little bit better with the propeller stopped because we've got the engine actually idling. The engine's helping it turn. It's not all drag turning the propeller. But when we shut the engine down, we were up high over an airport and just circling up at 8,000 feet, and we pulled the throttle back to idle, then we pulled the mixture back. And we just wanted to do a glide with the engine idling and see how bad it was. Now, with the engine windmilling, the propeller windmilling and turning the engine. The glide was much worse, about 15% worse, gliding with a windmilling engine. But here's the thing. We had the throttle closed. We had the mixture shut off. We had a good engine. So what happened was, at best glide speed, 67 knots in the 172 SP, we could not keep the propeller turning because of the engine being closed up, the air pump that it is, if you close off one end of it, the throttle, the air couldn't pump, so the prop stopped. And what we learned is if we actually opened the throttle all the way, the air could get through and the propeller could windmill because now the air isn't stopped inside that air pump. The interesting part of that is if you had an engine failure, if you have the wherewithal to think about it and your engine air induction system isn't, you know, doesn't have another hole in it, pulling the throttle closed or, you know, pulling the throttle closed might help you stop the propeller without actually having to slow down to near stall speed and significantly increase your glide ratio. So to compare an engine idle to engine stopped, it's very similar, but an engine windmilling failed in windmilling compared to idling. It was about a 15% increase in performance with the engine idling than it was stopped. And that was very similar than it was windmilling. I'm going to screw everybody up with this. If the propeller is windmilling, you have a lot more drag. If you're at idle, you're simulating a stopped prop. It's the best way I could put that one. And then Someone also asked me, I'm going to move on to another one because these are kind of short. What are three things you wish every pilot knew? VX, VA, and VY for the airplane they're flying. That's my answer to the three things I wish every pilot knew. VX, VA, and VY. I'm sorry, VGlide, VA, and VY of the airplane they're flying. VX is not so much as important to me. It is important, but VGlide, if you know your glide speed, it's not on the airspeed indicator. VA is not on the airspeed indicator, and neither is VY. Those three are not indicated on your airspeed indicator. So those are the three things that I wish a pilot would know.
And it's interesting, you when you say that, I immediately think of the conversation that we had once had where you were advising me against VX because you brought up VX.
Yeah, VX is good to know in an emergency when you need to outclimb a cloud or terrain ahead. The conversation that I have with a lot of pilots is if you have to take off and climb at VX immediately after takeoff, a loss of an engine is going to result in a crash because you, in most airplanes, because you can't get the speed back without lowering the nose, pointing it to the ground, or holding a flat attitude and pancaking in a stall. Either way, it's dangerous to have to plan to fly out at VX initially. If you're doing that, you've probably already messed up by, I think, using poor judgment. I'm going to hear letters on that one.
Yeah, no kidding. Wow. That's pretty good stuff for, I'm paying close attention. It never occurred to me before about closing the throttle plate versus opening the throttle plate and what that would do for windmilling prop. So you've done that. You've gone up and stopped the prop and, yes. And did that scare you?
We weren't planning on stopping the propeller. We were just planning on windmilling it versus idle. And with it windmilling, with the throttle closed, we couldn't keep the propeller turning. And we sped up a little. The propeller just did not want to keep turning. That air pump was shut off on one end with that throttle plate closed. And when I realized that, I just opened the throttle and boom, engine's windmilling real easily. Like trying
never,
to...
Never occurred to me. You learn something new every one of these shows.
Yeah, it hadn't occurred to me either. Not something you typically teach, but something to file away in the back of your mind in case you have an engine failure. It depends on why the engine failed as to whether or not that will work.
Wow. Very, very cool. Okay. My turn?
Yeah.
All right. I'm going to go the opposite of what I did last time. I get the same kind of question of what are the top maintenance items you would, I guess, defer or be wary of? I'm going to be very careful on this because legally I don't want to say, like, avoid maintenance. But what are the ones that you kind of get a little cringy about? And I thought about that. And the first one that came to mind is sort of blindly following, and this is another one I'm being very specific, airframe manufacturers' maintenance lists of exactly, times, hours, and time in service. The list that comes with your aircraft of what is not legally required, not part of an annual inspection, not an inspection item, but just what they recommend you do. If anyone really looked at them, you'd be, wow, I didn't know that that's what they wanted to do. These are things like replacing seatbelt webbing every 10 years. Like there are things like without condition, like there are things you can figure out for yourself. And the act of doing the work can introduce issues. And so be thoughtful about that. Is my message. Be really, really careful about looking or taking advice from a mechanic who simply looks at something and says, it's this many years, it's this many, hours, and that's in this basic maintenance guide. Question why, think about it, get some logic to it, make sure it makes sense before you opt in for it.
Yeah, I had some rusty clevis bolts on my airplane in various places. And I thought, just for cosmetic purposes, I thought, let's just replace those. But they're all in very important structural places where they wouldn't be there. And I thought, well, am I introducing the risk of having another possible problem if they're not swapped out perfectly or done right or torqued right or whatever? So just for the sake of cosmetics, I decided not to.
Well, that's a perfect example, right? I mean, I looked at those specific clevis bolts on your aircraft, and we're talking in this case about just the slightest surface, corrosion on it. Nothing that even remotely compromises the integrity of the bolt in what we were looking at. And yet, had those been replaced, we have to start thinking about all the things that could go wrong, which you mentioned. Could they be put in incorrectly? Could they be torqued incorrectly? Could an airworthiness directive come out where it turns out that those were suspected unapproved parts and what you thought you got turns out we see that, right? Oh, this wasn't magnaflux properly, or we can't actually find the source of it. And it turns out that the FAA likes to call them counterfeit parts, but suspected unapproved parts. There's so many things. And then the question is for what? Because you could have just gone and taking a little polish and all of a sudden they look great.
Right. Yeah. And on that note, if there's anybody out there owns a Citabria with that metal push start button, if anybody knows what the best way to polish that up, mine has corrosion all over it. It's rough. I want it smooth and shiny again. I'm guessing I don't know what to use on that. Flitz or Neverdoll or what. I don't know. Maybe you know.
Maybe start washing your hands.
Oh.
I'll try that. That's a good question. I'll bet you can polish it somehow. And I'm sure the idea, I can see you taking a power buffer to your panel, trying to like work on where the button is right now. Now you're gonna call me is how do I repaint something when I accidentally damaged the Radionics? Right.
I quite often mess something up by trying to make something else better all the time.
All right. My next item on the list is when you do multiple things when you only need one. And that is things like when people reach out to me and they say, I've got one cylinder that's got a problem. And I'm thinking I'm just going to do all of them. That's a perfect example where human nature, I feel the same pull inside myself, says, oh, well, if we just do all of it, we don't have to worry about it for the long period of time. And yet the statistics, the data, and the reality of what we see, even anecdotally, is quite the opposite. You've gone from one cylinder to break in and either three or five other cylinders that are fine, that you have no known problem with, and one that you have to risk, did we put it on right? Does it break in properly? Was it manufactured properly? Is there an airworthiness directive going to come out on it? Whatever it is. And now you've decided to extend that risk to your entire engine and extend the additional risks of things like loosening all, when you take off all the cylinders on an engine, the engine loses its the torque that's actually holding it together, the tension that holds the bearings in place. There's processes and steps to be very careful about how you do that to make sure it's done properly. So all the risk just goes through the roof. And if you were to lose that one cylinder at night over the mountains, you're probably going to be okay. But if you messed up and you've got all your cylinders now, it's much more of a risk. And I know people that do it for all sorts of things. They do it for that, they do it for tires, they do it for whatever. They do it for spark plugs. So just think about why you're doing something. If things are really timed out and it really makes sense and you can make a good case for it, that's different. If all your tires are pretty worn out and one of them you go in flat spot, that's different than I've got, you know, pretty good stuff going on, but I just decided to keep everything at exactly the same time. So that's one.
That makes a lot of sense. And I'm also on that note wondering, should I stagger the magneto inspections, not do them both at the same time?
You absolutely can. And in that case, what you would avoid, so we do see cases where because the, you know, where an overhaul facility has a problem, there's a problem with parts, there's a problem with the way the process was done or the way they were tested, and the likelihood that both of them are going to follow through and have the same thing is higher if they, you know, were done at the same time. And reality is, yeah, sure, why not do one this annual, one the next annual? I mean, you're not saving labor,
right,
in that case.
Right. So I want to throw on top of that a piloting technique that goes along with your number. I think that was four, whatever it was. But don't ever throw multiple switches at the same time. I see people grab a gang of switches and throw them. If they're going to hit all the landing lights on and the taxi lights, they'll hit them all at once with four fingers and hit all lights on, or even in the airliner, I'll see it, or, you know, both engine and AIS on at the same time, whatever it is. I was trained, this is kind of an old school thing, but just turn one thing on at a time. If something's going to go bad when you flip the switch, multiple switches flipped at the same time will not tell you which one of them was the culprit. Also, you know, when you turn a lot of electrical things on at once, they spike more than they draw, right? Mm-hmm. And so you have everything spiking and you might over spike your generator or overload or whatever. I don't know if that's even close, but it's just a technique and a philosophy of just one switch at a time. Turn one thing on at a time, whether it goes to, you know, your engine anti-ice or your wing anti-ice or whatever it is you're turning on landing lights, just one switch at a time, just a operating technique that I try to teach.
I like that a lot. That makes an awful lot of sense. And you touched on something that is very accurate. And that is that the larger the draw that you put, instantaneous draw, the larger the inrush current you're going to have, and the larger the bounce back also, because there is voltage bounce back. Even when you shut something off, it goes away, and then you can get an overvoltage that's a transient. So yeah, it doesn't make sense to just hit everything all at the same time. That's an excellent, excellent point.
So that makes me wonder about a radio master switch, an avionics master switch. Should you also use the switch on the avionics, or is that too much of a spike to hit all your avionics at once?
I think that's generally reasonable to do for a couple reasons. One is because most avionics have a fairly soft start in what they do. When you look at how they start up, they boot up sort of like a PC does. And the big draw that happens on avionics are with actually things like transmitting. You know, whether it's your transponder or whether it's your radio, that's where you're getting a lot of power that's happening. So I don't worry too much about booting everything up at the same time with an avionics master.
Cool.
But you know, you mentioned lighting, and it's interesting because LED lighting is a big source of problem for that. We rightly so think of LED lighting as being this wonderful advancement. You get better light output for less power to make it happen. And yet it's actually, in an instantaneous level, more of a draw in some cases than the old incandescent system was, because heating up a filament or charging a capacitor for a strobe system is a more gradual process. And
that's interesting.
And you lose that when you switch to LEDs. They are just on, off, on, off. And you get a big draw when it hits that on. And you know, you got to make sure the rest of your system can match that.
That's good to know.
And that happens to be one of my bonus ones, so I'll go there as well. And that is the idea of upgrading your system, whether it be adding a lot of avionics, things in your panel, LED lights, all the goodies, power for charging people's personal devices for you and your passengers, doing all of that without considering your electrical system, without upgrading your alternator, without looking at your voltage regulator. That's one of my no-nos.
That makes sense. That makes a lot of sense. Well, cool.
Okay, rest of my list here. Oil usage, doing maintenance, major maintenance, based solely on my aircraft's using a lot of oil. That's not something I want to see people pulling an engine apart for. There are limits. Continental and Lycoming generally are somewhere around 1 quart per hour. That's a lot of oil to be using. But someone who says to me, I got to put a quart in every 3 hours of flight. I say that I hope that gets better. That's too bad. But I don't necessarily recommend, if it's not causing the engine to run rough, if it's not fouling your plugs, if there isn't something happening that's affecting your flying, you're just sad about having to put a quart of oil in every 3 hours. That's not pull a cylinder world in my book.
I had a friend doing that, and he was over servicing, and that's why. Because I said, look at your belly. He's topping it off to 8 or 9 quarts every time, when 7 is the happy spot.
Well, you know, that's an interesting point. I get questions, and some of the questions that came in had to do with how much oil to put in. And it's not a simple answer. It is true that, as you mentioned, different engines have a different kind of happy spot, where if you go above that to the full capacity of the sump, like 12 on a Continental or like 8 on a four-cylinder Lycoming, it'll tend to spit it out to a certain point on your belly. If that's a healthy spot, like it's say 10 quarts on a Continental or 7 on a, then that's generally fine. If it's blowing out more, it could be that you've got a bad crank seal. It could be that there's something wrong with your breather system. There's a lot of things. Could get a lot of blow by in the cylinders. There's something else that could be causing it. However, one of the things that people don't think about is oil does a lot of different jobs in our engines. And one of the jobs, very important jobs it does, is it's responsible for about 25% of the cooling of our engine. And that doesn't just happen in the oil cooler. That's really capacity based. The amount of oil that you have is this, it's your heat sink, it's your reservoir of hot versus cold oil, or let's say very hot versus, you know, medium hot oil going through your sump and getting to mix and stay at a lower temperature. And this is especially important on things like Cirrus and IO550N engines and things that only that are big engines with only an 8 quart sump. You really want to keep the most oil you can in your plane that it will tolerate. That's the best way of thinking about that.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I also read in my engine manual that the Lycoming would run with like 2.5 quarts or 3 quarts. It was something very surprisingly low. Not saying that's the normal departure. Like
We'll run with.
Yeah, it will run. Yeah. I wouldn't leave with that.
Exactly. It'll run with it, but I wouldn't want to make that my go-to for it.
Right.
And then the last thing I've got on my list here is constant preheating. The idea of plugging in your plane and just going away if you're in a very cold climate, please don't do that. Corrosion is very temperature sensitive. All you have to do is go on the internet and look for what, you know, the rates of corrosion on steel, for example, on bare steel are based on temperature. And you find that things corrode very, very slowly when they're very cold. And very, very quickly when they're hot. And so that plus the moisture and acids that are in oil after you've flown, you really should only be heating it when you need to. And if you do want something that's going to be on all the time, then you need to simulate what it would be like when it's warm everywhere, like on a summer day. And that means you need a cowl blanket. You need to make sure everything in that under that cowl is heated to the same temperature so that you're not creating moisture as a vapor that is then condensing on cooler parts and causing those to corrode.
That makes a lot of sense. That's all good stuff. I was asked, were you finished with that?
Yeah.
Cool. I was asked, for pleasure flying, just for enjoyment, do you prefer tail draggers or tricycle gear airplanes? My favorite airplane is the one that I'm in at the time. If the opportunity presents itself to fly both, I'm going to take a tail dragger every time. It's more fun. I'm more engaged with the flying. It's more hands-on. It's not so much of a operating systems as it is. I'm connected to flight controls, and I'm just feeling, you know, the airplane around me and flying it. That's why I got one sitting here, that beautiful model of the airplane that I fly, a Citabria. Dad just wrote an interesting article that came out in this month's Pilot Magazine, AOPA Pilot Magazine, about how the insurance company has said that tail dragger pilots are less likely to get into an accident than nose wheel, or, you know, tricycle gear airplane pilots. And it was very interesting. He got a lot of feedback on that, most of it positive. And then, of course, the people who'd never flown tail draggers came back and they wanted to argue the point. but it was very interesting, the facts and how connected you are to the tail dragger itself. So it depends on the airplane. If you said a 152 tricycle or a P-51 tail dragger, that's an obvious one to me, you know. Another question I got was, is flying dangerous? And I thought, that's a good question. My answer is no, flying is hazardous. Pilots are dangerous. And I think I say that to be funny and coy, but I'm also serious. There are hazards with flying, and I've said this many times. So it's up to the pilot to not make it dangerous by looking at all the hazards, being a little bit afraid, not a lot, but enough fear to make you do the right thing to mitigate that hazard. I mean, getting out of bed is hazardous. You know, if there are things you're going to trip over, so you can mitigate that by just watching where you step. You know, so there's all kinds of things that we have in flying that can make it dangerous if you, the pilot, don't mitigate that hazard to make it safe. So that's my answer to that one. And then I got a couple more with relating to emergencies. And so one person asked, while flying with my wife and a headache starts, my wife says I don't look well. Do I declare an emergency? And I think that's a very good question. A lot of these questions are fantastic because this is one of those situations where you're going to try to talk yourself out of it. You always are trying to talk yourself into saying, I feel fine. If you don't normally have a headache, you're not fine. There is something wrong and you want to get on the ground as soon as you can. If there's some kind of delay because of ATC or other traffic, that's when you want to declare an emergency, when you're not getting what you need. I need to be the first one to land. I don't want to extend my downwind. I need to get on the ground, because what starts out as a headache could turn into something very serious. We don't need to get into all the possibilities, but just take my word for that. Anybody with a medical background out there could probably attest to that. You don't want anything abnormal. You don't want to talk yourself into normalizing something that isn't normal. And so when your wife, who looks at you every day, says, you don't look good, take that seriously. You know, my wife tells me that, but it's a different reason. but
Brian, you brought something up with that I want to ask you about, because you added the factor, it's not just the headache, it's someone observing you and saying, you don't look well.
Right.
To me, I thought you were going to say, yeah, you do declare an emergency, because what occurred to me was not just the priority aspect of it, but starting the line of communication for your co-pilot, for the person with you, for your passenger. If you feel something medical isn't right, wouldn't it be good to have them be on the frequency and know that you push the button and you've already started the chain, I guess, of communication?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's another aspect of it that's very important. Declaring the emergency might also get emergency people out there, which might be paramedics on top of that. I mean, would you rather have a paramedic show up when you didn't need them, or have them not show up and you really did need them? So it's one of those, you know, we have medical emergencies on the airplane all the time with someone. I just had one recently that a passenger's heart rate was very high. And so we declared a medical emergency. We got priority and got it on the ground, and we had paramedics meet the airplane. That's another thing I would ask for, if anything is really out of the ordinary, is go to an airport with services like that, if it's not too far away, and request an ambulance, meet you at the airplane. And ATC can help arrange for that as well.
Wow.
I think it's very important. So on that note, someone also asked, after declaring an emergency, what are key points you should log to discuss with the tower or flight or center? Or sometimes the city will come interview. I had an emergency declaration one time, got priority. This is when I lost one cylinder. The airplane was vibrating very badly. First thing I did was climb. I want to get altitude tonight, and I point the airplane toward the airport. Then they said, make right traffic for blah, blah, blah. And I said, no, I'd rather make a straight in for the opposite runway. I did that and landed. But the first person to meet me was airport operations vehicle, and they wanted my driver's license and pilot's license. They wanted to see all of that, because I guess they have to file a report as well. But if you declare an emergency, make note of the time that you did it. Also make note of your location, because with those two pieces of information, you can go back and gather almost anything you need. You can go back and look at you know, where you were on FlightAware. You can look at ADS-B data. You can look at and get ATC audio just by knowing where you were and what time that was. So those are really the two important things. The rest can be obtained. So I think those are really important. Then also, I think that this might be something you could help with, Jeff, is if it's an engine issue, what parameters do you want to? I take a picture of all the engine instruments, because that might help the mechanic. I know it has in the airliner at times, where they would look at something I wouldn't have thought to look at. Of course, now they all know it before I land, because it's all transmitted. But for a GA pilot, if you have an engine issue, what things would you want to record?
Well, that's an interesting point. And I'd start with the first thing that you just said, which is noting the time.
Yeah.
And location, because you got to find it in the data. And that isn't always that easy to do.
And if you don't have an engine monitor, though, you might want to take a photograph, create your own data.
Right. Well, so the second thing is, yeah, as long as it's safe for you to do, to be using your phone and take a picture, then absolutely. I do want to go back for a second there, because I think you're absolutely right. Noting times and locations, I would do that for anything. You mentioned it for emergencies, but I've done it before where I feel like I might have made a mistake and I might need to file a NASA form. I might have gone into an airspace I wasn't supposed to, or I might, you know, there's like any number of things that could have happened. And writing a quick note like this time, this place, really helps you do that.
That's a good idea. And for flight, and I know some other avionics manufacturers have an event type button where you can just hit an event button and it stores puts a bookmark there in the data. For flight does that. I know that Honeywell and some of their equipment does that. I'm not sure about Garmin and Avidyne, if they have an event button where you can just push a button and it notes that point in time. So you can go put a bookmark there and go find it later. So that could be helpful as well. Another question on that note, along with declaring emergencies, is being in command of an airplane. And someone said, I understand that I'm pilot in command when I'm flying my airplane, but could you have a discussion on what that means when dealing with ATC? So I think that is a good conversation. We've had that on other programs that I've done, talking about by being pilot in command. But basically, ATC, you have to remember what their role is. They're there to separate you from other aircraft when you're operating in the system. So when you are, say, IFR, or you ask for, you're in Class Bravo or Alpha airspace, they're separating services of aircraft operating in the system. So they are not necessarily giving you directions on how to get to your destination or how to get to your how to circumnavigate airspace and all that. That's up to you. And weather, of course, is up to you as well. ATC is not there. They might help you by pointing out what they see on their radar, but it's up to you, the pilot. Okay, I'm pilot in command of this airplane. I need to keep it clear of the weather. ATC is a tool that I use to help me keep from hitting other airplanes when I'm flying IFR. They can also help in many other ways if I ask them to. So being a good pilot in command of an airplane is utilizing, and I shouldn't say, the question said dealing with ATC, and I don't think you should look at it that way. ATC is an external resource and a valuable tool that, if used properly, can help a pilot do a lot of things. You can ask, if you're, you know, pride goeth before the fall, you don't know where you are, you can ask ATC and say, look, I'm disoriented, can you tell me how to get to whatever airport, request vectors, or hey, I know there's an airplane out there, can you help me avoid them? They will help you do that. But you need to utilize their tools. They can also make phone calls for you if you need an ambulance. So like I said, utilizing ATC is more important. To think of it that way, as a good pilot in command, utilizing ATC rather than having to deal with them is something that's just kind of a pain in the butt.
Yeah, it makes sense. Wow, those are all good ones. I like that a lot.
Yeah, there's so many good questions. We're going to have a lot of fun with these episodes.
I know. All right, well, I'm going to go next one on my list here.
Yeah.
And that is, does compression really matter? Why do we still do it? You know, it's interesting. If we look at the prevailing thought in the industry by experts like Mike Bush and the folks that I work with and all these others, and really what people see, if we look at it, what we're learning is that compression checks help lead us towards things that do matter, but in and of themselves aren't necessarily telling us critical things. So they can start the discussion. They're mandated in terms of AC 4313 says this is what you do as part of an annual inspection, and compression check is there. And having a limit, a go, no go on it is there, which is something that I think people don't really understand. It's really important when you get compressions during an annual inspection or any other inspection from your mechanic that you should have a number for every single cylinder, and you should have what's called the master orifice reading for that day. The tool itself, the actual compression gauge, has a lever on it that you turn, I don't even go there, that you turn, and it then lets air out through a calibrated orifice and says, this is that reading. Well, that's your minimum. That's the go, no go number. And it varies based on the barometric pressure of the day and humidity and things like that. The calibration of the instrument, how the gauges are reading. It is really important. In fact, I've always sort of advocated, why are we looking at numbers that are like out of 80? I got 73 out of 80. I got 78 out of 80. Well, that's great. But what you really need to know is what's the number you got compared to the master orifice number of that day? Because that's your minimum. That's your no-go.
I'm not understanding what you mean by that. And by master orifice, is that like a, I'm not, you can explain that.
Okay. So if you've ever seen the tool that's used to check compression on an engine, mm-hmm. has two gauges. One is the input pressure that you set to, you know, what you want to have in it, which is usually like 80 PSI, depends on the engine. And the other is the one that once you open it up is how much is staying in the cylinder versus leakage that's happening. And so 80 in, and then it's holding 68, whatever the number is. And that's what you see when someone, when you're at annual inspection or whatever, when they say, hey, Brian, these were your compressions. It was 74, 72, 76, 77. However, that instrument, that tool has another lever on it. And that other lever lets air out, doesn't go into your cylinder. It's a test of the tool. And it lets air out through a calibrated hole. A calibrated master orifice, it's called.
Oh, I see. It's something on the tool, not the airplane.
It's on the tool. It's not on the airplane. It's a self-check built into the tool that is designed to say, this is the minimum leakage. Think of it as your cylinder is allowed to leak as much air as this little tiny hole would.
I gotcha.
And we calibrated this hole when we made the tool.
Okay.
But the gauges can be off. The gauges can be off based on a number of things. And so we actually want to see what the gauge says when it's in your cylinder and what the gauge says when it's going out through this calibrated hole.
I gotcha. That makes sense.
And as long as it's above that number, frankly, you're fine, right? When it comes to the compression portion of that. What's far more important and why compression is so helpful is where is it leaking? So when the pressure is going into the cylinder, you can use your calibrated ear and listen at the oil filler, take the cap off. That should be where you hear most of any leakage you're always going to have leakage, but that's where you should hear air hissing. You can go down to your air filter or your inlet and see if you hear any there. If you hear it there, it's going out through the intake valves. And that's important to know. That's a problem. And then you can go to the exhaust and you can listen at your exhaust and see if you hear air coming out there, which means it's going out past your exhaust valves.
I learned a neat trick working on car engines.
A very small amount there, but you don't want much.
Makes sense. A little trick for, you know, like I learned doing working on car engines. Like I had a vacuum pump leak trying to find it. My father-in-law grabbed a tube. You know, like a nylon tube, put one hole up to his ear and took the other and kind of moved it around in the engine compartment and could hear, and you could actually locate the leak. And maybe that works on an airplane too. Yeah. That's kind of like a makeshift stethoscope.
So for me, the idea is compression does matter because doing it can identify if you have air leakage and where it's coming out, but it doesn't tell you everything. And then you follow that with borescope inspection because you could have very, very little leakage, great compression, and all the leakage is happening at one specific spot in a valve and it's burning its way through. And if you don't fix it, it's going to cause a problem. Or you could have low compression where it's going past the rings and you find your valves are fine and you're still passing the master orifice number. You look at it, you're horrified because it's 55 or whatever. And you're like, I've never had anything that's been 55, but the master orifice says 48 and you're fine. It could be different 5 hours from now. It could be that the gaps in the rings lined up. It could be anything. You're fine. The reality is that the power made by the engine is not actually directly related to what that compression number is that you see.
Interesting. It makes sense.
In all but the most extreme cases.
Yeah, it makes sense. Someone asked me, what is your biggest concern in general aviation? Like, what is the biggest concern for me is a mid-air collision. We're all out there flying around and I see pilots looking inside the cockpit so long and long a period of time and not looking out the window that it almost scares me. I'm like, when I see them doing that, I'm out the window. I'm just very aggressive and assertive about that. We are supposed to, per the FAR, maintain vigilance so as to see and avoid. That's actually in the regulation. And I see too many pilots not doing that. And there are way too many mid-air collisions aircraft that are there to be seen, but the pilot doesn't see them. That's my biggest concern in general aviation. Things can break and we're trained to handle it. You get in a mid-air, there's generally no coming back from that. The second two things are apathy and complacency, things that we all suffer from. And I think the biggest anecdote to that is to be aware of it. Watch out when you feel apathy or you feel complacent, like everything's going to be okay. I've done this 1,000 times. What could possibly go wrong? You know, and when you start feeling very comfortable, that's the time to say, okay, what am I missing? And just pay attention.
So, yeah, that's excellent, excellent advice.
Yeah, that's, let's see. Can you talk a bit more about using the trim tab on soft field landings? I mentioned that on one of our programs, and we had I got a lot of questions about that. And this person admitted, I was distracted for that part of it. Thank you. Well, you need to kind of focus on this and pay attention for a second. So it depends on the kind of trim tabs you have. But basically, I ask my students or whoever I'm giving a flight review to, okay, you're making a soft field landing. Is there anything you can do to the trim to hold the wheel, the nose wheel off the ground longer or as long as possible? And they say, yeah, I'm going to trim nose up. And that's the temptation because you think it's helping you hold the nose up, but that's not. It's opposite from what is true. You can hold the nose up longer if you put full nose down trim. Think of it as it's getting harder to pull back. Why is it getting harder to pull back? You're not having the trim tab help you. You're having it assert more force on the air, so it's going to have more of an effect. You're adding more surface area. Yeah, more surface area to help push that tail down. So full nose down trim on a soft field landing to hold. If I actually had to land in like the sand, something really soft, I don't want that nose wheel digging in, and I want to get down to a survivable speed before the nose wheel drops. Try it on your next flight. Try a soft field landing. Don't go full nose down trim until you're on the ground. As soon as you touch down and you're holding the nose off, start trimming full nose down trim. It'll get heavier and heavier on the wheel, but pull it all the way back. Don't let that wheel touch down until the trim is full nose down and your control wheel is all the way back, and you'll be surprised. Like, it'll be maybe 10 or 20 knots, maybe 30, depends on the airplane, but you'll be surprised at how long you can hold the nose off the ground.
Wow. That makes a lot of sense. And I'm going to go play around with that. And it's true. Like, all you have to do is put one person in the cockpit or do it, you know, back and forth by getting in and out, but go and move your trim tab to that position and like look at how much surface area you then have versus kind of taking it away like an anti-servo tab.
Right. And we're looking at where you're moving an elevator and a trim tab, not like an airplane with a stabilator. If you're moving the whole stabilizer, that's a different kind of story. But like on a typical Cessna with a trim tab on the back of an elevator, that will certainly make a big difference.
Wow. Awesome. Well, I only have one more on my list that in the time that we have, because of course we're going to have many of these.
yeah, obviously.
And one I got quite a few about has to do with shimmy and people saying, what do I do about nose wheel shimmy? And my answer to that is that it's really important to look at it as a complete system, and that the first thing you need to do when you're dealing with shimmy, and there's some different complications if it's happening on a tailwheel aircraft versus a nose wheel aircraft. So I'll focus on nose wheels right now. The first thing is actually taking the shimmy damper out of the system and then like removing it, not flying that way, but removing it for maintenance, and then looking at the rest of the system. How loose is it? What kind of slop do you have in the system right now? What's your tire look like? Does it look like it's uneven and having flat spots? Or is it just linkages throughout there that are so loose that you're allowing this oscillation to take place? The role of a shimmy damper is to take the natural shimmy that could occur in the best case scenario and control it, damp it down. But in a way, you sort of shouldn't need it in a healthy system. And as the system becomes more and more unhealthy by having excess play or having uneven things or flat spotted tire or problems with bearings, whatever ends up happening there, it's fighting against trying to be a Band-Aid on it. And if all you do is fix it, you're just going to wear it right back out. It's just it's not meant to be a great Band-Aid that you just use in a poor system. And so my answer to that is you should use that as an opportunity that your aircraft is sending you a message. It could be that your shimmy damper has failed. It could be that your shimmy damper is out of fluid or something else is going on. But if you're really feeling a fair amount of shimmy in that case, and you have a shimmy damper, then chances are it's working too hard. And you should first deal with everything underlying and then put on a better Band-Aid. And this isn't true of things like, Grumman's and Cirrus and things that don't have shimmy dampers. Those cases, you only focus on fixing the system where you don't have enough tension on the washers or there's some other thing causing it. But my answer is always look at the underlying cause, fix it first.
It makes a lot of sense. It's like saying my engine failed and I had to pull the chute, so now I have to fix the chute.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, Brian, somehow we ate up all of our time.
That's crazy. I just have one quick one. Someone said, Brian, you may need to work on enunciation because when you said the shift show, my wife's eyes opened and she did a double take on the screen. Yes, the shift show is going to be this next Thursday, this coming Thursday, 2 days from now on the 13th. Be sure to join us. I got Ned Parks joining me on that. We're going to talk about wake turbulence, and not only any wake, but we're going to focus on helicopter wake turbulence, which is something a lot of pilots take for granted.
I love that. My favorite show. We can put your wife aside. I am your biggest fan other than her, I suppose.
Well, I appreciate that. It's been a lot of fun. It's been very popular, and I'm really looking forward to this next one. It's going to be an interesting one. I'm going to share some wake turbulence experiences that I had actually as recent as a week ago.
Oh, that's awesome. And then we'll be back with Social Flight Live on November 18th. That's November 18th. We've got astronaut Hoot Gibson. He's making his third appearance on the show, and he wants to wrap up his story by talking about record setting. He set some unbelievable records. We're going to talk about the things he did to engineer the aircraft to make those records happen, as well as what it's like to set records. And many of his records still stand. So it's going to be a really fascinating show. He's an amazing, amazing human being. And so absolutely love that. And then we're back in December here on Cockpit to Cal. And we're here on December 9th. That's it. I just looked at my sheet. December 9th. Here on Cockpit to Cal, we'll have another great show happening then. So again, socialflightlive.com. Go check that out for that show. And Cockpit to Cal, if you're here, be back with us next December on the 9th.
That's awesome. And the shift show episode will be on November 13th. So look forward to seeing you there at 7 p.m. Central. Just go to theshiftshow.tv. You can see all the archived episodes. And if you're there at 7 p.m., you'll see the live episode on November 13th.
Excellent. Well, my friend, thank you so much for joining me on this show. As always, it is my favorite show of the month.
Well, thank you too. You know, from everywhere, from doing wobble checks and reaming things and looking at master orifices, this has been a lot of fun, but very educational to me. I always learn something just when we get together and talk. So that's very cool. Thank you.
All right. And thanks to all of you for taking time out of your evening to join us here on Cockpit to Cal. We'll see you next time. And until then, I'm Jeff Simon from Social Flight. And I wish you all blue skies.
Good night, everyone.